Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. It's Friday, February 26th. We have a couple of informational hearings today. I'm going to start with the Oregon Innovation Plan. Invite Heather Stafford and whomever you would like to bring with you. I know you've got a roster here. We're excited about hearing from all of them. And just as a note of introduction, it's sort of a follow-on conversation to the one we had in January, I think it was, where we drove by the innovation plan quickly. We now have substantially more time to go into more detail. We're glad you're back and eager to hear from you.
Thank you, Chair Reed and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here. For the record, my name is Heather Stafford, Assistant Director of Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Business Oregon. And we have spoken about the innovation plan before and about Business Oregon's innovation strategy through our Division of Innovation and Entrepreneurship, and I thought I would walk through just a few slides and a few ideas and actually just let you hear from people in the field and look at how we're actually, as the Innovation Council, looking at innovation investments and some experiments we've done, and let them tell you really about the need that we're looking at. So you'll hear from Matt Baudet and John Brashears first to talk about our SBIR programs, and then I'll bring a couple other folks up, Peter Lund and Carl Mundorf. So how do I use this? So I'll quickly walk through the innovation index that we've put together and some target industries for our agency that Business Oregon recently identified. We'll talk a little of the Oregon Innovation Plan, which you all have copies of, the Rural Entrepreneurship Development Program that we're piloting, and the SBIR-STTR program that we've also done a couple of pilots with, and then you'll hear from our guests. So the elements of an innovation ecosystem the way that we're looking at it is comprised of three primary elements. So you have to support innovation, you have to support entrepreneurship, and you have to have capital to make that engine run. So with innovation, we look at building clusters, looking at our strongest industries, and look at ways where innovation can play a critical role in growing those more quickly in industries where Oregon has a particular competitive advantage already. And in entrepreneurship, we look at that almost as an infrastructure. If you think of building capacity to support innovation, to support entrepreneurship, and mentoring, especially that's statewide and connects the state, and then build an accessible pipeline for access to capital, which is always tricky, but compatible capital that represents all kinds of entrepreneurs, not just the ones we consider perhaps tech and angel entrepreneurs, but what do all kinds of Oregon entrepreneurs need, and can we do a better job of opening up capital for those folks? So this is the innovation scorecard. This is part of an innovation index that's actually published on our website. And a few notable markers on this index are where we're particularly strong versus the U.S. average economy is in patents, which we're sixth in the country for patents. And you know, I think maybe that's in large part because of Intel, but it is a marker where we do shine compared to the rest of the country.
Is that per capita? Or raw number, or
the patents is raw number.
Wow. Okay.
And R&D investments were 10th in the country. Surprisingly, that also may, you know, it's public sector, so it may be, you know, also largely because of our heavy high tech sector. And then SBIR-STTR is another really interesting notable one. We're 11th in the country for bringing home those awards. And SBIR is it's a federal program. Agencies put 2.8% of their research budgets, and they give grants to small companies.
It's an acronym too, yes?
It's an acronym, Small Business Innovation Research Grant. And then there's a STTR, which is Technology Transfer, which is mostly for universities. So I'll talk more about SBIR later, but we do bring home about $45.5 million in SBIR money as a state every year. And so it's really something that we're very strong at, and sometimes despite ourselves. So we're looking at that closely and how we can bring even more dollars home for our companies. Manufacturing GDP is an interesting one. Our economy is the second most dependent on manufacturing in the country. So that's something, you know, I think that we all kind of intuitively know, but to see it and see the trends over time, how much we really do rely on manufacturing as a state is certainly notable. We're 12th in the country for exports, the dependency on exports for our economy, and the STEM workforce, we're 15th in the country. So where more focus is needed, I'll say, when we look at this innovation index is where we have the opportunity to really grow this and make a difference. So where we have a downward trend where we can try and turn it up is in our income from university licensing. We're 22nd in the country and headed downward. So can we do better at getting licensing income? We do a lot of invention. We do a lot of R&D, but somehow that's not translating into licensing income for our universities. Venture capital investments are on a downward trend. We're 18th in the country and headed downwards. So, you know, could we do more through things like the Oregon Growth Board to connect ourselves to venture capital in a more competitive way? The Kauffman Index for new entrepreneurship, so startups, brand new startups, we're on a downward trend as well. We're 29th in the country. A lot of states are aggressively going after their startup ecosystem and putting a lot of money behind that. University startups were 27th, and that's also a downward trend. So when we look at those and we look at strategies, and this is what the Oregon Innovation Council is particularly interested in, is how can we support, you know, R&D better? How can we support access to especially early stage capital for hardware invention type of companies? And then how do we build better regional capacity so that all Oregonians have the opportunity to plug into the network of resources? So I want to talk a little bit about Business Oregon's new target industries, and I want to put a little lens on these. These have been approved by the Business Oregon Commission. The lens I want to put on them is how Business Oregon's Office of Innovation and Entrepreneurship and Oregon Inc. in particular look at each of these. So advanced manufacturing, we look at sort of what you would consider a disruptor to that, which is additive manufacturing, 3D printing, those types of technologies. How can we turn those potential disruptors into competitive advantages for something that we have identified as a very strong industry for us? High tech, same things. How do we look at the Internet of Things and smart goods, and how do we integrate those into our very strong high-tech industry? Outdoor gear and apparel, of course, there's wearable technologies and digital health technologies. How can we integrate those into what we're doing? Food and beverage, there's artisan production and food and beverage that is relevant for our whole state. How can we better support that and weave in innovation? Forestry and wood products, of course, cross-laminated timber everyone hears a lot about, but how can we weave in innovation into that particular industry? And then business services, Oregon's seeing a skyrocket of what you would call the solopreneur, and we're not currently tracking these types of entrepreneurs very well through traditional jobs numbers. So how do we look at you know, these are independent filmmakers, independent artists, programmers, engineers, but they work for themselves, and so they're not necessarily 1099 employees, but they're the solopreneur, and they contribute a lot to the economy, but we're struggling with metrics on how do we capture that activity more effectively. So that's a really interesting area for us. And the Oregon Innovation Plan is a little bit of a different tactic and than we've taken in the past, and it's the 10-year anniversary, and we did walk you through the plan a little bit before when we were here. A few notable points about this particular plan is that it's really a reflection point or a fresh look at where are we. Let's take kind of a census of our economy, what's happened in innovation, what's particularly relevant for Oregon, before we make any funding or budget decisions on how Oregon Inc. is going to use its dollars that it's been allocated effectively. So it's a new world, lots of new technology changes, lots of cultural changes. There's 12 of the 15 private sector board members are new to the Oregon Innovation Council. So it's a chance to get them up to speed historically, what's happened. It's really been very nice to have a mix of people who've been there since the AUCAD days and people now who have fresh eyes on this board.
It is worth saying, I think, that So I'm your ex officio non-voting member from the House, but they're all public meetings, and Representative Reardon has come, but anyone is welcome. Mm-hmm. Interruption, please.
And that board meets quarterly, and they're public. That's on our website as well, if anyone wants to come. They're livelier discussions than they've been in a while, so they're really interesting board meetings. And then very early when Dave Chen set up as the first chair of Oregon Innovation Council, he said something I found interesting, is that the council decided they needed to have some tactical wins in order to earn the right to be strategic, and I thought that was interesting. So I think after a 10-year mark and a lot of good, 7-to-1 leverage, and there's a lot of good things that have really, really happened with this council and the investments that they've made, we took that opportunity to be more strategic. So to take a real look at the innovation economy here in Oregon, and then put together, based on those findings, a strategy and a budget that we'll put forward. And so in the past, they've been together, and I think strategically we'd like to separate them out so that we're really diving into the data, the opportunities, and listening to the types of private sector people that you're going to hear from today about what the real opportunities are so that we can make really smart investments. So the new timing, the innovation plan going forward will be published by December 31st every odd year. Oregon Inc. will deliver the innovation plan. It will contain an updated version of the innovation index, so we can look at that every 2 years over time. It'll have economic indicators. It will benchmark with other states. As we learn more and more, that I think metric will become more interesting. And performance of the previous investments for the previous biennium and before, and then the latest innovations. So taking a look at what's on the cutting edge, what should we be paying attention to. And then we're going to separate out, like I said, the innovation plan from the actual Oregon Inc. budget.
It's also worth noting for the committee, the other big change that happened in our 2015 session, remember that the Innovation Council has both the signature research centers and the roster of industry initiatives. So the first time those signature research centers were built into the base budget of Business Oregon. So the nature of them will change, but the expectation is that there is something there, as opposed to previous years where the expectation was that there was not something there.
So yeah, thank you, Chair. Well. That's a notable difference, and it allows us to empower the Audit and Accountability Committee to actually tie the funding that we allocate to these initiatives directly to performance in a better way as well. So the six-month strategy that the board is looking at is to make catalytic investments with a special focus on private, public, educational, and philanthropic partners. So we've been working with the Oregon Talent Council, Oregon Growth Board, bringing in these bodies that are also looking at this ecosystem and trying to align strategies as best as possible. With the limited dollars we all have, how can we accomplish more together in a focused way? And the Strategic Planning Committee for Oregon Inc. is going to make structural recommendations as far as the budget goes by April 29th, which is the next full council meeting, and it's a public meeting, you're all welcome to come. Proactive investment strategy. Taking a very deep dive into the data that Business Oregon put together on our target industry groups and choosing three or four of those that really feel most promising and being proactive about making investments in those is that with the highest return on investment. So I wanted to talk about a couple of things we've done with in partnership with the Governor's Office and the Strategic Reserve Fund to experiment with what could we do. Let's place some small bets and see if we can pilot a couple of things. One of those brand new things is a rural entrepreneurship program. And we received 24 applications, collaborative applications, from all over the state for just what was a $250,000 grant. There was only going to be 3 to 4 awards. So it was a way for us to learn a lot about the ideas that are out there in rural about supporting entrepreneurship, about the gaps, about the need. And we were really, really impressed with the amount of collaboration that's happening. There are a lot of communities out there that are primed and ready for this type of capacity. So we chose two general areas or hubs that we're going to be piloting an integrated network. So we chose Northeast Oregon and Southwest Oregon. And we're going to be creating centers of entrepreneurship, so not tangible centers, of course, with $250,000 that we're not going to build buildings. But what we're going to try and do is create strategic plans for those communities, for centers. And then we're going to build programs for those centers. So we're playing with the idea of, can you deliver virtual content and have someone in a room facilitate it, right? So the virtual model never works very well by itself because it's not engaging. The in-person model doesn't work so well in rural because sometimes they lack resources, programming, expertise, that kind of thing. So can we build some sort of learning network where we connect those two things, where you still have the cohort experience where people still come in the room and they're together, but you're delivering content in an engaging way. So you're supporting your content providers. And this isn't about taking urban and stamping it on these rural communities. This is about connecting rural to rural, right? So we're really excited about it, and we will certainly keep you posted on this as it develops. And then to tee these two off, I want to talk a little bit about two different programs that we've piloted with the governor's office in SBIR and STTR. Again, that's a small business innovation research grant or a small business technology transfer grant. And these are federal programs that that 11 different agencies do. I said we bring home about $45 million a year. We're 11th in the country, so there's a lot to work from. This is a strong area for us. I would say with a little bit of support, we identified, talking to some of these kinds of companies, some gaps in their ability to either, because they're very competitive. So our Phase Zero program was piloted in 2014, and it was $400,000, and it was to help companies that were applying for these very complex federal grants to get some pre-review, to get some grant writing support, to get some help mentoring as they go along, so that their chances of success are much higher. And there's also a matching program so that if they were successful and did receive one, we would kick in a little bit of match to support things that grant didn't support. And so far it's been wildly successful. We'll have a annual report published here in the next couple of months about that first one.
So a mechanical question on Phase Two. An applicant is successful. Am I right in recalling that once they're successful, there's not a geographic tax, so they can take that success and go anywhere? So part of the value of the match is to say you get that match if you stay in Oregon. Have I got that right?
Chair Reed and members of the committee, yes, that's exactly right. We're trying to create a more nurturing, fertile environment for inventors to be able to take their technologies and develop them here and have the support system to stay here. We have great access to capital, in fact. Once the company gets product market fit and minimum viable product, once they get to that stage, where it's really hard for hardware-based manufacturing, advanced manufacturing companies, is in that early part, that early stage, and getting access to this kind of funding. This funding is also not trivial. It's up to $150,000 for a phase one, and if you get a phase two, it can be up to $1.5 million. And this is non-dilutive money. This doesn't come off of their cap table, so they can still go fundraise with private investors and venture capital later and have a lot of equity to offer. And these folks will talk about that a lot more, I think. The phase two program is underway now. We're taking applications, and it's another $400,000. And this is for that next tier of company. We identified another gap. And those companies that have raised that $1 million, maybe a couple of $1 million rounds, there are a lot of things that won't cover. It mostly covers technology. And what we wanted to support was the business development. So if we could have some matching in there for those successful companies that have brought a couple of $1 million back home for their technology, could we match a little bit for them in order to pursue business development, marketing, whatever it was that was the gap for them to get customers eventually? So on that note, I would love to introduce first Matt Baudet with NEMA Metrics, and he was an award of our Phase Zero program.
Very good. Baudet, please.
So, Chair Reed, members of the committee, I am Matt Baudet, the CEO of biotechnology startup Pneumometrics from Eugene, Oregon. And today I'm going to be talking about the impact that Business Oregon has had on our trajectory. But before I do, I'm going to start off by, if you could click to the next slide, by talking about the problem that my company set out to solve. Essentially, drug development is an incredibly inefficient and expensive process. And it results in, you know, high cost for the medicines that we all take, as well as forcing the hand of pharmaceutical companies to neglect diseases that are unprofitable. If you click to the next slide. Now, Pneumometrics has developed a revolutionary alternative to the traditional mouse model that is one of the key cost drivers in drug discovery. Believe it or not, it's a microscopic worm that acts as an incredibly cheap and yet highly predictive stand-in for humans on research on 62% of all diseases. And to give you a little bit of a comparison, an experiment with our system costs a few thousand dollars, while the comparable mouse experiment would cost close to $1 million. However,
I'm sorry, could you
Representative Rubin, go ahead, please.
Could you elaborate on that just a little bit? I just have a hard time figuring out, are you just overpaying the mice, or does it take longer, or what?
Mice have good agents, yeah.
So, they're kind of on the stock market.
So, Chair Reed and members of the committee, the mice that are used in drug discovery, they both have a lot of oversight to make sure that they are never inappropriately used for cruelty to animals, as well as they are genetically very tightly engineered. And so a single mouse that represents a specific disease, such as ALS, can cost as much as $26,000 for a single mouse. In fact, there's a company in Portland that does great business on replacing, I know this sounds a little bit fantastic, but replacing the kidneys inside mice with human kidneys. And that is one of the, it can produce amazing results, but it is incredibly expensive. These worms, on the other hand, they can also represent humans, but the amount of oversight and the cost to raise and maintain them is dramatically less.
Okay, thank you.
Good question. I appreciate this insight. Thank you.
So back to this.
Can I interrupt one more time?
Representative McKeown, before we go to the question. So many questions. And we could derail you for a very long time.
Yes, we could.
Those of us with curious minds up here, and we all do. The physical structure of a worm is incredibly different than a mouse. Is there enough genetic commonality that it allows? I mean, the life cycle is shorter, obviously. Maybe I don't know if that's helpful or not. But the genetic structure must be close enough that you can make this happen. I mean, give me the 30-second. How does this work?
So
we have kidneys?
So Representative Reed and members of the committee, the NIH has spent about $2 billion to fully understand this animal. And in fact, it is the most well-understood animal in the entire world.
The worm.
Okay. The nematode worm.
Yes.
And it is
out of my garden, and I'm happy.
Exactly, and it is in my lab, and I'm very, very happy.
All right.
And at the end of the day, what they've understood is, because they know it so well, they did the Worm Genome Project before the Human Genome Project. They did the neuronal tracing project in worms before they even thought to do it in humans.
Okay.
So they know everything about this worm, and therefore they are able to make all those connections to what it means for humans.
I got to tell this story. I'm sorry. I apologize.
Yeah.
The door open. Here we go.
I have a friend who's 92 years old and still plays the stock market. And several years ago, he told me he'd bought a company that was invested in lab mice. And it was doing real well. I had a chance to visit one of the laboratories in Southern California, one of the drug manufacturing companies. And they were showing how they're using technology now to do all the research. It's on the computer. And I asked the people, does this mean you'll no longer need mice? And he said, oh, yeah, we're always going to have lab mice to do our research. You can't just use the computer-generated person and do this stuff. So I'm going to have to call my 91-year-old friend and I say, get rid of that stock, because now we got worms coming along. So I thought.
Even metrics, there you go.
Yeah. So even though that our technology has amazing potential, we still faced the standard valley of death that all technology startups come against. Essentially, will we be able to reach a financially stable stage with the resources that are available to us? Next slide. And let me tell you, NEMA Metrics has taken full advantage of all the resources that have been available to us. If you look on this chart, we have received research support dollars from the NIH SBIR program, from two of the signature research facilities in Oregon, ONAMI and OTRADI. But we still faced a funding gap as we try to transition from just a technology to a real business. And in a lot of ways, for us, this is where the magic happened. First, at the Fertilab Thinkubator in Eugene, Oregon, we were given the infrastructure and the support that was needed to live in the real world outside of the university. Second, with Oregon RAIN, we were given guidance and helped focus our business model. And then, if you click to the next slide, with Business Oregon, we were given critical support to vet our product out in the real world. And this market information we use not only to prepare for our phase two SBIR application, that was for slightly over $1 million, but we also were able to net customers. And with that, we were actually investment ready. Now, I can't say how much private investment that we have raised so far since we're not closed this round, but I can tell you that it's in the low seven figures.
When does it close?
Well, very, very soon.
Okay. What's the minimum buy?
And so where are we today? We have product on the shelf. We have customers lining up. We have 10 high-wage employees, and we are still growing. And we're on track for $1 million in revenue. And really, I want to thank you and thank Business Oregon for the pivotal support in this critical growth stage. And then thank you for letting me tell my story.
Thank you. I'm gonna suggest we hold the questions, because I bet there are a bunch more for you, and hear from Mr. Brashears, and then we can ask questions of both at the same time. Mr. Brashears, please.
Thank you, Chair Reed and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Brashears. I'm CEO of Architectural Applications based in Portland, Oregon. I beg your pardon. We as a civilization are currently experiencing the most rapid rate of urbanization in our history, and it's largely happening in the hottest and most humid regions of the globe. Architectural Applications has developed a product called the Airflow Panel, which substantially cuts the energy required for building air conditioning systems through a device that integrates into the building envelope, into the wall system of the building, and it provides a host of other advantages in so doing. Incidentally, it was developed based on the principles at work in fish gills, and it's a novel separation process. Over the past 5 years, with the support first of the federal government's ARPA-E program, a new, very prestigious clean tech funding program, and then through a series of grants awarded through the U.S. Department of Energy's SBIR and STTR programs, we've successfully been able to develop this product from a concept through a bench-scale validation to two full-scale operational demonstrations, one in California and one in Singapore. So we've been able to achieve very successful product validation. We've also been very fortunate and successful in achieving a number of other milestones. On December 31st of 2015, a great New Year's Eve gift, the U.S. Patent Office agreed to allow one of our patents, which had been critically held up in that office, and we believe on that basis patents in China and Singapore are going to issue because of that precedent. Last summer, we closed our first sale. And sales, as my colleague has said, are critically important. And we've formed a partnership with Hunter Douglas Facades, a global building envelope and building cladding sales organization. We've established manufacturing of the product in Redmond, Oregon, and we're building that quickly. Notably, the critical component of our that goes inside of this, however, is still manufactured in Canada. But the current STTR funding that we're receiving, our current Phase 2 grant, is to support work with the very deep and profound expertise of the Microproducts Breakthrough Institute at Oregon State University to develop an additive manufacturing process that's going to produce this product in a low-cost and more efficient manner so that we can take that, we can jettison our supplier in Canada and start manufacturing that critical component as well right here in Oregon. What we need is investment in order to grow the company, create the jobs, and propel our product to market. And we're very close, we feel. But again, as my colleague said, what we require is sales. We've validated the product in the parlance of this industry, and what we now need to do is validate the market. The SBIR program, which we've heard about, is wonderful in that each of these federal agencies awards funding to small companies to do research and development. And in their wisdom, they require a very, very carefully crafted commercialization plan, a roadmap for how the small business is going to take this product from a scientific lab concept mm-hmm. to an actual viable business. The paradox, however, is that with most of these agencies, federal law precludes the small company from spending that funding on anything except research and development activities. So while they require a commercialization plan, they preclude us from spending the dollars to execute that plan. And that's where Business Oregon comes in.
Can I interrupt for just a second? Raise some cue and have
just a
question,
quick, when you, so you're talking about cladding for construction. Is this climate sensitive, or is this, can this be globally marketed, or is it is there a parameter with climate?
There is a very strong parameter with climate.
Okay.
The more extreme the climate, the more energy that is required to condition that air and create the comfortable condition inside the building. Very little conditioning, either heating or cooling, is required in Los Angeles, for example. A bit is required in Portland. A lot is required in Minneapolis, and a lot is required in Miami. So we do have some geographic markets.
So you have a specific targeted geographic market is what I guess what I was asking.
We do. And that I slipped past it very quickly, but the reason I pointed out the humid climates in Southeast Asia is mm-hmm. because that's where our largest market actually is. For that reason, they use more air conditioning than anybody else.
Thank you.
Right. So we feel we're on the cusp of bringing all these things together, coalescing all these milestones that we've hit. And we want to do that by closing as many of these sales as possible. We're in active discussions right now to sell this product to an internationally recognized green building architecture firm, the busiest airport in North America, the largest developer in both Hong Kong and mainland China, the most prestigious university in a humid climate in this country, and a major government building in Vietnam, one of the most rapidly urbanizing countries on the face of the earth. Any one of these, and preferably multiple of these sales, would have profound implications in us bringing the airflow panel to market and breaking down that resistance to market adoption that is faced by all new companies. And to every one of these very, very prestigious companies and customers, our product represents an intriguing proposition, but also a risk. Because like any new product, it's slightly unproven, it's very unfamiliar, and there's a fear factor. There's a hesitation on the part of the owner for that reason. What we need is the ability and the resources to help partner with these customers to try and lower that perceived risk in their eyes by providing training, by providing some critical components, and some additional pieces of both hardware and software that they wouldn't ordinarily have that will allow them to adopt these and so that we can get into the market and prove our technology. And that is what this current program, a Phase 2 SBIR, would provide for us. It would allow us to overcome that hurdle successfully, we hope, cross the valley of death that we saw presented by my colleague, and bring this product, the airflow panel, who will then have its full marketing manufacturing cycle start to finish done in Oregon and sell it to the rest of the world.
Oh.
So thank you very much for this. Thank you for your support of these kinds of programs, and I beg you to continue to consider them very seriously for the profound effects they have.
Thank you. I wish we could have all the rest of the legislature in for these kinds of hearings. Mostly, I want to speak for everybody else in the committee, but I'm convinced of the value of them. I think one of our challenges is generally making sure that people who work in other critical areas of the legislature have an exposure to it, so we'll have to think about that. Any questions for either of these entrepreneurs?
Thank you for your good work.
Yes, thank you. Please keep it up.
Thank you.
Heather, introduce her.
So next up, I'd like you to hear from a couple of key people building very interesting industries where we are, as the state of Oregon, showing very, very, we're leading the nation in a lot of ways in both of these industries. And they're both very new and very emerging on the disruption side, I would say, of some very traditional industries. So first up is Peter Lund. He's the chair of the Oregon Gamers Organization.
So we're transitioning from individual companies and technologies to industries now.
To industries,
okay.
Yes.
Very good. Mr. Lund, please.
Thank you so much.
One question first, I guess.
No, just an apology. I'm going to have to dash out here in just a couple of minutes, and I want you to know it's not lack of interest at all. It's just
me as well. Thank you.
We're in that
crazy time we're in right
no
now.
No worries. I'll try Stage to grab your session. Attention quickly so you can't leave. But if
Perfect.
You
may I make a comment as
yes,
well?
Yes, Representative McEwen, please.
If the conversation is turning to gaming, I have a nephew who graduated college and was on his way to law school, took a summer job between college and law school to do some gaming testing in Seattle. Never left Bungie. He's been there now for 15 years and doing quite well, thank you. To his mother's chagrin, law school went by the wayside, and the kid is still working for Bungie. And so I can tell you, nobody believed it could be done. It can be done.
It can indeed.
One more thing before you get started. Representative Wisnett has some hands. You're just going to hand it to him as they leave.
And
we'll talk about this later on. Representative Wisnett, please. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Reed, members of the committee. Again, my name is Peter Lund. I'm the chair of the Oregon Games Organization and COO of Super Genius in Oregon City. Today I'm here to share a bit about the opportunity we have as a state in the emerging virtual and mixed reality markets. These are very new technologies, so I'm going to start out with some definitions. I know last year out in the Galleria there were a couple of people that were showing off the Oculus Rift, so maybe some of you have used them before. These are very interesting things. Virtual reality means that all of your visual and audio input is basically digital. You put a headset on your face and you can move around and see a new and interesting world. Augmented or mixed reality means three-dimensional overlay on the real world, and it is something that has developers in my industry excited in a way that I haven't seen in my career. This is something that has folks excited and has people whose profession is market forecasting extremely excited. I'd like to start out with a video that demonstrates what this technology is, and this is from the Microsoft Corporation, and the video demonstrates
Look
their
around.
HoloLens technology, which is an
technology
augmented reality
is all around
platform.
Us. We use it in every aspect of our lives. It enables us to do amazing things. But what if we could go further? What if we could go beyond the screen? Where your digital world is blended with your real world. Now we can. This is the world with holograms. What will they enable us to do? New ways to visualize our work.
You know, I have an idea for the fuel tank.
New ways to share ideas with each other.
How are things going your end?
I just put the images in OneDrive.
Perfect.
More immersive ways to play. New ways to teach and learn.
So put the new trap in the place of the old one.
Now what?
And tighten here and here.
New ways to collaborate and explore the places we've never been.
Look at this formation. Let's take a closer look.
And new ways to create the things we imagine. Because when you change the way you see the world, you can change the world you see. This is Microsoft HoloLens.
Yeah, so we live in the future.
And Microsoft didn't even send a representative today.
they had some.
Are you
down
the person?
Just last
yeah.
week, okay. So okay. I'm actually okay. talking to these guys at a pretty good clip, and they are very excited about what we're doing here in the state. And so that's what I'll go into right now. So the. And thank you for
Joe.
Your time.
Yeah. And good morning, everyone.
They're playing the next video.
Now, Joe just showed you I think they are incredible things with Windows.
Thank you, John.
From the little screen to the...
So this is a market forecast from the folks over at DigiCapital. They've projected that this market is going to be worth over $150 billion in the next 5 years. And as you can see, most of that is going to be on the augmented reality side. That's the HoloLens that we just spoke about. If you shift over. And a lot of this development and a lot of the growth is going to be on the enterprise side of things. So that means building tools for healthcare, architecture, engineering, construction, manufacturing, design, etc. The interesting thing about this particular type of development is that the development cycle changes when we get into three-dimensional user experience. So if you think about the big tech booms that we've seen in our lifetimes, 2000s when you could, you know, charge $40,000 to build a website with some Flash, and then those same people after that market corrected itself went straight into mobile applications. And building a website and building a mobile app have very similar skill sets, so it was easy for people to transition into building mobile apps. The barrier for development in this market is substantially higher because you're talking about developing in three-dimensional environments. And generally, these programs and these products are developed in 3D games engines like Unity and Unreal, which happens to be what we do. So the big question is, how can Oregon benefit from this? And there are three things that make our position right now unique and exciting. The first is that we have a fantastic development community here. We've got a quickly growing industry with many, many talented studios. Our company works with some of the best publishers in the world. We work with Disney and Activision and 2K. The largest games cluster in the state is actually in Eugene, so this isn't just a regional cluster. This is something that's distributed throughout the state, and we have some of the best talent in the world. The other thing that we have going for us is that as an industry, we have pivoted to serve this development need. So as an organization, all of the developers in the state have said, hey, you know what? We can build tools that are going to help people solve problems in the real world, not just the entertainment industry. And as far as I know, we're the only state where all of the developers have pivoted and said, hey, we want to build for these platforms. We're the ninth largest. Yeah, go ahead.
Department of Defense, are they involved in this, or did they help you, or did you help them, or how?
I assume that DOD is involved with Microsoft. One of our constituent companies, Pipeworks in Eugene, does work closely with DOD.
I'd be surprised.
The other thing that we have going for us is that the same product developed here in Oregon is going to be 10 to 20% cheaper than a product developed in Seattle or San Francisco. So Washington controls the hardware market in augmented reality with the HoloLens. San Francisco controls the hardware market in virtual reality with the Oculus. Nobody controls the development market yet because it hasn't emerged. And we have the talent, but we're cheaper than our competitors. That's great. The most exciting thing that we have is a unique edge in our workforce pipeline. For years, our industry has had to import talent from out of state, and so we've been working with our local educational institutions from the K-12 pipeline through to our community colleges and to our publicly funded universities to try to establish a pathway for Oregon students to come and work for companies like ours. Last year, Microsoft announced a grant through their HoloLens program. It was highly, highly competitive because this is very new and exciting stuff. And there were hundreds of applicants from around the world. They announced five winners last year. And those were UC Berkeley, Virginia Tech, Carnegie Mellon, Dartmouth, and Clackamas Community College. That's extremely exciting. If you think about it, right now, Oregon is the only place in the world where you can study development on these platforms without being accepted to and paying tuition at a Tier 1 research institute. This is a big deal. So with all of that in place, we have an amazing opportunity. We look forward to working with Oregon Inc. and with the legislature to take advantage of this amazing market and to make Oregon the place where we build these experiences.
Can I ask a question?
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Gallegos, please.
Yeah, how do you explain that, the Clackamas?
You took my question too. Thank you. Everyone had that question. That's great.
Yeah, it's a really good question. So CCC offered a very unique investment opportunity for Microsoft. I think it kind of evened out their portfolio of educational institutions. But the reason why I think they chose Clackamas Community College is because they built a coalition around their program. So it wasn't just CCC that applied. It was CCC, Intel, and Oregon Storyboard. So that brought the teaching component, the research component, and an incubator component to that program. And what they're going to be doing is building educational tools on the platform and building tools for the automotive repair program at Clackamas Community College.
And remember that the Storyboard is one of the other elements of Oregon Inc. that had existed for a little while before that. So they're coming together. It's nice.
Great.
Good.
Super.
Cool.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Carl, please.
Chair Reed, member of the committee, thank you for the opportunity this morning to come and provide some testimony around an area that I think is important to the state of Oregon. My name is Carl Mundorf, and I'm currently the co-director of the OSU Advantage Accelerator RAIN Corvallis, as well as the director of the Austin Entrepreneurship Program. And in the past, I've been director of research programs at Oregon Best and helped write the grant that we received from the EDA for advanced manufacturing and CLT feasibility study. So what I'd like to talk to you today about is ag tech and the opportunity that this state has. Whoops, where did it go here? Great. Sorry for that delay. So as we all know, there is a significant economic divide between rural and urban. And one way that we help to be able to affect that is through that diversity of the number of crops that we have, the geography differences that we have, and the microclimates we have. You're able to test for products in a wide variety of atmospheres that can be found globally. So when we talk about that, this diversity, we can look at ag products such as pear, shrimp, beets, wheat, blueberries, wine grapes, mint, watermelons. It just goes on and on. We have over 220 specialty crops, very few commodity crops. And again, the importance of that is a device that you create that can affect a specialty crop can affect that specialty crop globally. So we're a test bed, a very small test bed that can affect global markets. And just scroll. Okay.
Is that me?
Yeah. No, I don't think so.
When we talk about
strange
leveraging our natural resources, what we need to do is really convert these into higher and better use products. And one example of that would be forest waste. If we think of forest waste in the state of Oregon, we actually are the Saudi Arabia of wood biomass. And so what do you do with all this? Because it really affects forest health, and it's not economical to collect and utilize today. But if you can create a value-added product out of that, make it into biochar, and then you use the biochar, which is highly porous, and coat a seed with it, like we've done in eastern Oregon with hard red winter wheat seed, you're able to perhaps grow that crop every year rather than every other year because it's going to hold moisture and nutrients much closer to that rootstock. Ag tech is really about high tech and the Internet of Things and sensor devices. It's about low tech and, as I just mentioned, the utilization, repurposing of ag waste. It's we have a statewide resources when it comes to the SBDCs, the Oregon State Extension System, and a lot of other assets, including the new program that Heather's introducing. some of the companies. So we are already involved in ag tech in this state, and this is just an example of some of the companies that have been supported through state resources to develop their products. Just a few I'd like to mention is Walking Point Farms, which is a veteran-owned business that worked with this biomass product, has now created an all-organic natural fertilizer that comes from garden and food waste. And they just recently got into 22 Costcos in the northern tier of the country. Another example is Honeycomb. So they're creating ag drones, and they're manufacturing these in Wilsonville.
Ryan Jensen has been before the committee a couple of times, but we're glad. Please remind us.
The opportunity for his ag drone is he's able to create data sets that create actionable data for farmers to be able to understand how to deploy resources such as NPK or water. And the more they can do that on a precision basis, then the more effective and efficient they are in their raw material costs for the deployment of that. And then also we get less runoff of those types of materials into our water systems. We've had interest. We're able to talk about this type of technology with the Vice Minister of Land and Resources with the People's Republic of China. And they were immediately ready to take this on as a demonstration project in 80 acres in China. And then move it province-wide and then start trying to promote it nationally. So when I described that to Ryan, I'm not saying this was the cause, but it helped convince him to pursue this full-time. A third example is D.R. Johnson, which I'm sure you're aware of, the CLT products that they're creating. So the state of Oregon, actually, we commercialized plywood just after the turn of the century. Second wood product that we've commercialized here is oriented strand board that Louisiana Pacific put in the market in the 1990s. And there's no reason that we don't have the resources and the wherewithal and the strength to commercialize CLT as well. So AgTech, you know, is it really something or is this just a flash in the pan? One of the issues we have is we're going to have to feed about 9 billion people by 2050. So the interest in AgTech and how do you do this in the most cost-efficient basis is not going away. AgTech investment doubled last year to $4.6 billion. It's already on track this year to potentially double again. We have a lot of corporate strategics that are investing in this space, as well as traditional venture capitalists and private equity firms. And as you see in that last bullet point, it's just this wide variety of industries that we can affect. And again, the beauty of Oregon is we can, through our state, affect each of those market categories for those companies who want to pursue those opportunities. So AgTech can really revitalize the rural economy. We can be the test bed for this. We're already doing it. And investment sentiment's not going to go away any time in the near future.
I may be the only one here, but you have to tell me, what is that in the picture?
That is actually a grape cluster robot that can see and harvest grape clusters that are at the peak of ripeness.
Wow. Very cool. Made in Oregon?
Unfortunately, it's not in Oregon.
Okay. We'll be soon. All right.
But there's a lot of interest among the vineyards of trying to create technologies. One issue you've got is in harvesting grapes, you collect them in a basket, and then you have to run down the row and deliver them to a hopper. And there's a potential way to automate that process so the worker can continue to work, and then the baskets go to the collecting system at the end of the row. So we're not far away from having that in Oregon.
That's cool. Good.
Last thing I'd like to say is thank you for the support that the legislature has given to Business Oregon and the Oregon Innovation Council over the years. I'm a past serial entrepreneur. I actually joined Oregon Best to find my next opportunity. And through seeing the activity and the investment that the state has put into innovation entrepreneurship has led me in a whole new direction and just trying to support this endeavor statewide. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for being part of the effort. Heather, do you want to wrap up, or
should we go right to
questions?
Okay. One quick comment, really, is that these stories are two and four of many. There are a lot of industries on our radar, and this is why the Oregon Innovation Council is taking a very strategic and methodical approach at exploring all of these kinds of stories and opportunities before making investment decisions again in 2017. So we thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure, and we're available, and please come to Oregon Innovation Council board meetings if you like. We'd love to have you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Make sure Representative Wisner has a chance if he has any comments or questions. Thank you very much for coming. I hope that this is really indicative of what's what is to come, and I expect in my remaining time on this committee, we'll have you back perhaps in the fall, and let you give us a further update after the council has done more work. Representative Wisner, you were out there. Anything you want?
Just wanted to cool visit Redmond facilities.
Very good.
See how many we can help there.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Heather. Thanks very much.
Didn't want to miss him because I wanted to.
Yeah, absolutely. Good. So close the works, informational meeting on the innovation plan, and I'm glad now to open an informational meeting on financial aid fraud prevention at PCC. Dee Wilson, the bursar, is here, and I'm thrilled that we made it to you. I was worried that you were again going to be testifying before me alone. Thank you for sticking around the remainder. Please don't leave. We want to hear about this important work.
I was wondering if you'd
remember. Yes, of course. Oh, I do. I do. I still feel badly about that last time you were here. So please enlighten us.
Well, Chair Reed, Vice Chairs Gallegos and Wisnett, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dee Wilson. I'm the bursar at Portland Community College. Thank you for allowing me to testify today about a growing concern that we have at PCC and elsewhere, financial aid fraud. PCC and other colleges in Oregon have been targeted by criminal rings seeking to steal student financial aid funds. My hope today is to raise awareness about the impact of financial aid fraud at PCC and other colleges throughout the state. Criminals follow money, and financial aid has big financial payouts. For instance, in 2014, three people received over $1 million in financial aid over a four-year period. This was prosecuted. Their target was the California Community College System, but it could have just as easily been here in Oregon. These criminal rings are getting more and more sophisticated, and they're becoming harder to identify. As soon as they find out how we operate, they adapt and they change to that way of operation. Not only do they use up valuable resources at the college, but they take money out of the pockets of our students, and that's a big concern for us. These are students who rely on this money to get their education and make a better life for themselves. In 2011, the Department of Education issued a Dear Colleague letter that was an urgent call to action. The letter included a description of how these rings operate that I wanted to share with you because it's really spot on to what we see at PCC. The letter states, and I'm going to paraphrase because it's really hard to read Department of Education language. Fraud rings generally target institutions with low tuition, like PCC, with distance education programs. They involve a ringleader who gets identifying information from straw students. These are generally people who willingly provide their information, their personal information, for a financial cut. But it's not always willing accomplices, and I'll talk more about that later. The ringleader completes multiple financial aid applications using the information they collected, date of birth, social security number. They often falsify high school records or GED records. They then apply at open admission colleges like PCC, where we don't have anything to authenticate identity. It's just open. We're here, we're available to our whole population, and we don't do the authentication. The ringleader participates in just enough of the class to get their financial aid disbursement, and then they disappear. So, since 2012, how has it affected us? There have been 169 known instances of fraud at PCC, resulting in real dollar costs out of pocket of $433,000 to the college and over $1 million in financial aid obtained. This is a conservative number. We suspect it's about double that. Fraudsters are good at blending in, and in many cases they get away with a term or two of financial aid before they're identified, if they are ever identified. That said, we work very, very hard to keep the fraudsters at bay. I'm really pleased to report that this term we prevented fraudsters from getting away with $81,000 in financial aid. However, like other colleges, PCC is swimming against the tide. We have been hit by suspected fraud rings operating out of Georgia, Mississippi, Florida, Michigan, North Carolina, Nevada, and more. That's what we know about. Let me tell you about a ring that we call the barbershop ring. Rachel, who is one of our amazing financial aid advisors, is on our Fraud Busters committee. And she noticed a student with an unlikely address. When she looked it up, she found that it belonged to a barbershop on Northwest 23rd. So we started looking around for students with similar enrollment patterns, and we found 8 more people with addresses from nail salons to barbershop and, one at the Oregon Zoo. So the ring hit us twice. First, in 2014, they had 9 Straw students that registered and got away with $73,000 in financial aid. They took a break for a couple of terms, which is the way these rings operate. They'll hit you hard, disappear, go to their next target, and then come back. After taking a break, they came back with 12 newly minted identities going for a second round. I'm pleased to say they didn't get away with it twice. We stopped the ring the second time, and we haven't seen them come back yet. So this case really illustrates the hit and miss nature of identifying financial aid fraud. Sometimes we catch it, sometimes we don't. However, I cannot stress enough that students are losing out. The $73,000 that this barbershop ring got away with, the $433,000 that the college has spent out of its pocket in returning financial aid funds to the federal government should be money that goes to provide financial aid to students or services to students. Obviously, this is not just a PCC problem or an Oregon problem. It's a national problem. In the 2011 Dear Colleague letter, the Department of Education wrote, "More needs to be done by all institutions to prevent, identify, and report suspected distance education fraud in the federal student aid programs and to enable successful prosecution of offenders." In a 2013 risk report conducted by the Federal Office of Inspector General, they reported that fraudulent activity had increased 82% between AD-year 2009 and AD-year 2012 and had accounted for more than $187 million in financial aid fraud. I haven't seen new numbers, but I'm sure it's quite a bit higher. To help address this problem, the U.S. Department of Education is in the process of setting up a new fraud unit with 81 dedicated investigators. As proposed, the unit will focus on what's being done by colleges to detect, prevent, and report fraud. While it's good that there's dedicated resources, this approach continues to place the onus on the colleges. In an article from the Chronicle of Higher Education talking about it from June of 2014, it talks about critics assail the government's response to student aid fraud. In an area here I wanted to highlight, it says colleges are frustrated. The department keeps coming up with all of these things schools should do to prevent fraud, says Karen McCartney, a senior policy analyst with the National Association for Student Aid Administrators. Some administrators feel that perhaps the department needs to be introspective and consider what it could do. Many colleges say that most cases they refer to the Inspector General's office go nowhere. Over the past 5.5 years, the Apollo Group, one of the largest targets of fraud, they're the ones who are University of Phoenix, has referred 1,413 cases. 30 of those have been prosecuted. It goes on to say that many for-profit, like Apollo, and community colleges are taking steps to thwart fraud on their own. We certainly are. At the Apollo Group, the parent company for University of Phoenix, a 4-member fraud squad flagged 27,600 applicants as suspicious and stopped roughly 3/4 of them from getting aid. And that was a total disbursement of $155 million in federal student aid. Another community college, Rio Salado, which was the site of the Inspector General's largest fraud ring bust in 2009, now dedicates 3 staff members to verifying students' identity and records prior education. I finally got someone to help me. It's a third-time position, so 0.33 FTE. The process is very time-consuming, which I can personally attest. But Rio Salado's president says that it has eliminated 90% of the fraud cases. That's what we're hoping to do.
So Ms. Wilson, I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm just watching the clock a little bit, too, and recognizing everybody else's. I want to keep him here for the lessons from these experiences. I think we're getting the point of how serious it is. Okay. Can you help us understand what you've been doing at PCC, that the lessons we might be drawing, things we should be paying attention to and trying to help you spread to other community colleges and so on?
Chair Reed, I'm going to address that in my presentation.
Great.
Could we wait until then? Or would you like me to talk about it now?
Well, I'm not sure how much more you have planned. I'm just trying to calibrate. Okay.
Okay. Go not much.
Okay.
But the one thing that I wanted to point out is that there's a really delicate balance for us when we're doing this, and that is that we ensure that we're catching the fraudsters, but we're not impacting the people who legitimately deserve the aid. Mm-hmm. So just one other point I wanted to make is that there is a group that meets on a quarterly basis. I'm just now getting involved in this group. They've got Apollo, DeVry, Capella, and other large distance education companies. They've been working with a company named Identify to develop a white paper which has recommendations for the Department of Education and what they should do. A couple of these recommendations include increasing federal funding for prosecution of fraud rings. There's not much prosecution going on. Another one is to set up a database where these applications could be screened. There are 27 million new FAFSA applications that come in every term. They don't screen them. They don't look for elements of fraud that they expect the colleges to do. And that's one thing that we would like them to do. So to bring it back to Oregon and what we're doing here, I'll go ahead and share a quick presentation. This was shared with our cabinet, and I've updated the numbers for the committee. I also wanted to let you know that Corey will have a Word document with my presentation, and there are a whole bunch of references and articles for reading if you're interested.
Thank you.
So I already referenced the OIG report, so I won't go into that again. But there are 2 common types of financial aid fraud. Pell runners, these are people who are pretty much who they say they are and receive fraud in their own name, but they have little or no academic intent. Fraud rings that I've been talking about earlier are ones with a straw student who use willing accomplices or victims of ID theft. So this is an actual thing from Equifax showing that this person's deceased and was getting aid from us. Does anybody here from represent Forest Grove?
No, that's Representative McLean. Yeah. She's not on the committee.
Okay. We had one where an 82-year-old woman was a victim, and we're trying to prosecute that right now where it was one of her relatives doing it. So this is definitely not a victimless crime. What's happened at PCC recently? This is a trend line through spring of 15. Since then, we've had 94 new incidents identified. How much has been going on and for how long? Well, since between 2012 and 2015, we had 121 straw students and 300 at a cost to PCC of $350,000. Since then, $1 million in fraud attempted and the $433,000 cost to PCC. This is a map of financial aid fraud hotspots based on reports to the OIG that by the schools like DeVry and Capella and Apollo. It doesn't include any community colleges. They just went for national regional colleges. But we've been hit by just about every one of those fraud hotspots.
Does that reflect population generally? It looks like it might.
No. Not population. For example, one of the number one spot for fraud right now is Albany, Georgia. Mm. And so they're the one creating the most reports for fraud, and it's a small town.
Okay.
So common characteristics that we're seeing here, lack of testing, zero credits, common IP addresses, and students disappearing following superficial activity. They're enrolling in online courses. They have unusual enrollment patterns, late starting classes, late enrollment. So why do they target us? Because we have low tuition. When we have a low tuition, they have a bigger payout. We have open enrollment without the authentication. We have courses without prereqs. Sometimes people will actually try to make 1,000 attempts to find courses without prereqs so they can operate their fraud ring and have a book of classes. We have reciprocity agreements, which is why we've got a big ring out of Nevada, because they can get in-district tuition rates from PCC. And then there are college policies that can contribute. So to your question, Chair Reed, what is PCC doing? We have a red flag oversight committee that is our fraud prevention committee reports up to. Red flag is a regulatory oversight that's part of the GLBA. We have conflicting information reports, which allow us to kind of sift through the 10,000 applicants we might have in a term and focus on just 100 or 200 that look like there might be suspicious activity. We have ID verification and denial of service holds. So if we are suspicious, we'll require the person to verify their identity. If we're certain after we go through our due diligence and we find out that the person's not attending, we'll deny service and drop them out of their classes so they don't get aid. We have mandatory online orientation, and we have a fraud prevention policy that's run through legal counsel. Recommended next steps for the college. We're not there yet. We're talking about delaying financial aid disbursement. So people who are in late starting classes aren't getting financial aid before the classes start. That's one of the things that the fraudsters have found that they can do at PCC. Biometric signatures is a way of authenticating distance learning students through characteristics that are specific to them. So we're going to be doing an expanded pilot for that to see if that works. It could also help with academic fraud. A position to assist with investigation and reporting. Like I said, I've got one temporary position. I'd like to make that permanent and make it more hours. We would like to do fraud hotspot reporting. Looking at that hotspot map that we saw initially, we're considering contracting with that company to see if we can tap into that database. We're going to be doing a survey of colleges, both all of the community colleges in Oregon, to see what their experience is, how they are combating fraud, and to maybe put a coalition together for Oregon community colleges for best practices, and then hire a consultant to help identify what those best practices would be. So that concludes my presentation. Again, all of the articles at the bottom of the written testimony, plus here's a really good short read on preventing fraud at Oregon community colleges.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the information. Sorry to push you along a little bit there. I'm sure we could hear interminable stories about the other places, so I wanted to get to the local relevance and what you're doing, so I'm glad to have that information. Any questions or comments, Ms. Wilson?
Diane.
Representative Gagas, please.
You know, I'm just curious about your last point about coordinating and maybe talking to the other schools. And I would think the private schools, even though they have higher tuition rates, still I'd be very curious about what's going on statewide with regard to this issue.
Yeah.
Chair Reed, Vice Chair Gallegos, I do have a survey that I've developed. I'm in the process of refining that. And so I will be sending that out within the next 2 weeks.
Great.
So I'll
surveys to other schools or
to all Oregon community colleges.
Okay, good.
And then I'm also calling national colleges to see what their experience has been. So I'll be talking to about 12 other national colleges as well.
Good. You anticipated the question I was going to build on yours with. So when you get those results, please share them with our staff. I'm sure the committee would be interested in knowing what you learned.
Be happy to, Chair Reed.
Thank you. Anything else?
Okay.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. So we'll close the informational hearing on financial aid fraud prevention. And Representative Wisnett, before we go, I know you have some information to distribute. Please enlighten us.
I just wanted to keep the committee up to date. The work group on House Bill 2871 had a telephone hour conference call yesterday to prepare for the RFP. What you've got here is, remember I talked to you about, we're up to 31 courses. The money was for only I think 20, wasn't it? But
we started with 30, and then they reduced the amount, and the, what we had in the bill was 15. So if we can exceed that, so much the better.
Yeah, yeah, because what we've done is we're calling a series because one textbook is one. So we actually have 31 courses. The second page talks about how they're going to fund it. I think the decision was to use option two, a base plus fixed amount per additional course. Then you look at the criteria, how they're going to award, and there was some conversation about changing some things, and you see how they, I think I penciled those in.
Mm-hmm.
So just keep you advised. I'm really impressed with how they are moving forward with this, and we're getting, like I said, 31 instead of 20.
That's great.
And
how much has there been discussion? I remember when, as we were developing the bill, we were talking about the ability to use existing materials and,
yeah,
and reshape it or repurpose it as opposed to developing new. What's that been like?
It's really a political issue with the professors and the other people and trying to say, you know, how much is going to be produced or bought off the shelf.
Uh-huh.
And so I think we'll see what comes out as far as the grant process and who comes in.
Well, please, to the extent you're willing, keep pushing the idea that they can personalize what's already out there and we can go further with less money. So.
I completely agree with you, but it's the main thing is everyone's convinced we have to have the professors buy in and say this is acceptable.
I agree with that, too.
And that has to be high.
Yep.
So thank
Good.
You.
Thank you for that. So we have one more meeting scheduled, I think, next Wednesday. The HEC is going to come back to present an update on their strategic plan. If things went well and we were going to sign a day before that, we might not do it. But I think, based on the information I have, we'll probably be here on Wednesday and we can have that included information. We're not going to schedule anything beyond that just because hopefully we'll be done by then. So.
No meeting on Monday.
So 8:30 on Wednesday, correct? Very good.
Right.
Anything else? That's it. We're adjourned. Thank you. Thank you. Very good.
Right.
Anything else? That's it. We're adjourned.